We're going back down memory lane. It's the 19th of November, 1994, and Britain is about to be hit by a completely unique, out-of-this-world phenomenon. Guess what it is? It could be you! Does this ring the bell?
It does,
yeah. The launch of the National Lottery in 1994.
Yeah. Noel Edmonds, Saturday night.
It was a TV spectacular.
It was.
And absolutely. It came on regularly as those numbers got announced, week in and week out.
I was just looking into it a little bit. And actually, it's quite interesting because the first sort of idea for a National Lottery in the UK was first sort of put forward by, do you remember Robin Day, the old kind of political interviewer with the bow tie? Here we go, there we are.
Yeah.
And he wrote a letter to the Times in 1967. Because he noted what had happened in Australia, where the Sydney Opera House had been basically financed by public subscriptions via a lottery fund. Yeah. And so why don't we do something similar in the UK? But it goes back as far as that. And then, though, every other European country had a national lottery before we did. And we were really late on the game, which is really interesting.
What was the Irish sweepstake?
Wasn't that just a lotto?
That was something from memory, and this is growing up in Canada, was actually illegal to buy a ticket for.
Really?
Or to go on the sweep, however you did it.
Yeah.
But I do remember my father winning it.
Really?
And he won enough back in the early 60s to buy one of the first calculators. And when I tell you, do you remember the first early mobile phones that looked like bricks?
Yeah.
That's what the calculator looked like.
So
it must have been a significant sum of money. I don't remember seeing any of it myself, personally.
Yeah. But it was fascinating just listening to some of the archive material. John Major doing a speech in Parliament saying, you know, do you like a flutter? I like a flutter. Let's have a flutter on the National Lottery. And there was a lot of criticism under the surface that this would take money potentially that government might want to fund. And this was encouraging gambling and all that sort of thing. You wonder now if it would have got off the ground.
It was incredibly controversial, not least because everybody said, well, what will happen is the poor will buy the tickets. More than the rich.
Yep.
Therefore, the poor will become poorer because of the likelihood that they're
which is still an argument.
And then there is the whole gambling thing. Is it gambling to buy a lottery ticket? If it is gambling, does it actually feed some sort of lottery ticket addiction?
You two guys know more than me, but it must have been the most fundamental structural change in charity sector giving in the last three decades. It must have had a very profound effect.
I think it has, because it gave access to money, and certainly the difference in the pots of money they now have, whether it's for historical buildings or whatever. It'd be interesting to talk to her about, okay, so how do you choose what you fund and you don't fund?
So let's do the reveal. You're already teasing us there. Our guest today, and we're very excited about this one because she's a major, major player in the charity sector, is Dawn Austwick, who is the Chief Executive of the National Lottery Community Fund, formerly the Big Lottery, we should say. But hey, we haven't introduced ourselves yet.
No, not yet. I'm Keith Davis.
I'm Camilla McGibbon.
I'm David Prest, and this is Good Charity, Bad Charity. Thank you for listening. I think, Camilla, you've had experience of meeting Dawn before.
I first met her because I was involved in Tate Modern. She was the project manager. She then became CEO of the Esme Fairbairn Foundation, which is another charitable funder. They give huge sums of money. I mean, the National Lottery gives £500 million a year about, and Esme Fairbairn not far behind. She very kindly came to a charity that I was involved in when we were just getting off the ground in terms of our thinking as a funder. And everybody around the table kind of sat up. She very much gave us, sounds odd, but a sense of dignity about the importance of what we are doing.
Well, I'm the odd one out because I've never met her at this stage. So I'm really keen because it is such an important thing for the work that I do outside of, obviously, the podcast with my charity chairs. They are really, really interested in, how can we make our bid a higher percentage of success? So that, for me, is a really interesting part that I want to try and drill down on.
The good news is Dan Hardoon, our producer, is on the other side of the glass. He's just given us the thumbs up. Dawn Austwick is in the building. She's going to be our guest on Good Charity, Bad Charity after this bit of music. Welcome back. Good Charity, Bad Charity. We're delighted to have Dawn Austwick with us. Dawn was appointed Chief Exec of the National Lottery Community Fund at the end of 2013. She's led the development of the fund's strategic framework, People in the Lead. Prior to joining the fund, Dawn was Chief Exec of the Esme Fairbairn Foundation. But she began in fringe theatre, which we're going to talk a lot about, I think. But anyway, it's fantastic to have you here. We've just been talking about our first lottery experience and that kind of launch in 1994 of the National Lottery, as it then was. It's amazing to think it's 25 years ago. What do you remember about what you were doing at the time and what it meant to you?
It became incredibly important to me because absolutely at that moment, I got a phone call from Nick Serota at the Tate to say, would I be interested in coming to be the project director for what was then the new Gallery of Modern Art for the Tate on London's South Bank? The other slightly strange thing about that phone call was I actually said no.
Did you?
I did, yes. And I just started a new job. I put the phone down and I was in an open plan office and there was a sort of silence. Because clearly everyone had realised what was going on.
And they said to me,
did you just say no? And I said, yes. Went home, told my husband, and he said, are you crazy? Anyway, very, very, very luckily for me, they came back 10 days later or so and said, would you like to come in and talk about whether you can think of anybody who might be suitable? At which point I thought, this is an opportunity for us to...
Very smart, you see. And,
yeah.
And of course, very tied in with the lottery fund.
Well,
which
precisely.
Had a key part in
yes,
kind of
because event. The first thing that I had to do, I arrived in about January, February of 95. Yeah. And the first task was to assemble the bid to the Millennium Commission.
Right, yeah.
And it was a very deliberate decision on the part of Tate not to go to the Arts Council, but to go to the Millennium Commission to position this project as a project about the nation,
for the turn of the millennium,
which is absolutely how I saw it. I mean, I still remember the day we heard that we got the 50 million officially.
That's really interesting, isn't it? You know, here you are running the fund now, and you still have that memory of that first moment when you got the call.
Yeah. What happened? Was it a phone call?
No, very old technology. It was a fax. Yeah. And I remember looking at it and taking a very deep breath and thinking, shit, we've got to do this now because they've believed in us. They think
they've
we
given
can do
us
it.
The money.
I have this image of you getting this letter and I turn around the back to see if it was a joke.
Looking at it, though, it's really interesting. When the National Lottery was launched in 1994, and the original idea was that bridging between government funding and private philanthropy. How do you look back on that sort of starting ethos now?
I think what's interesting about our National Lottery is most of the other European National Lotteries, the money goes straight into the state's coffers. So John Major's inspirational vision was to create this notion of good causes and that actually it was about enabling people to lead kind of fulfilled, happy, good lives. It was for the whole nation. There was something for everybody in that. I mean, if you think about even our funding now, we make 12,000 grants a year. 11,000 of them are for £10,000 or less. You know, if you look over the kind of passage of time, there won't be a neighbourhood in the country that hasn't received some real grassroots bit of funding that has made a difference to the people that live there, as well as these kind of iconic national successes. I mean, if you think about the kind of Paralympic approach in this country, that's been transformed by lottery funding. I mean, it's absolutely staggering. And, you know, I remember being in the Olympic Stadium on one night of the Paralympics, and it was just the most moving, inspirational, joyous event. You know, without the National Lottery, we wouldn't have achieved that excellence.
You wouldn't, because many years ago, I was the director of the British Sports Association for the Disabled Athletics. And we were struggling.
Yeah.
You know, we couldn't get disabled sport on any agenda because of possibly the stigma of some of it as well.
Yeah.
So certainly, I'm really pleased that is the case. But it did dry up the Sports Council's funding because they didn't have as much. And I think Camilla may say they did the same for the Arts Council funding as well. So has that balance gone the other way where government aren't seeing the opportunity to fund because you're there? You know, and people can apply to you.
Well, I think if you looked at Sport England or Arts Council, you know, there is substantial grant in aid that sits alongside lottery revenue. I mean, I agree that the lottery revenue has grown as a proportion. I haven't got the kind of precise numbers like in front of me, but it would be interesting to look at actually has the overall cake has grown, in effect. So it's not a direct replacement in that sense. And obviously, you know, the charity sector has equally faced lots of funding pressures over the last few years, which makes our funding more vital for charities in some ways.
What do you think, Dawn, that your relationship broadly is with government? So yeah. If government has a change of policy, let's take universal credit, and that becomes problematic for communities, which you support, then as a big funder, I would imagine you're invited to sit around the table when some of these decisions are made. Now, is that true? Is that my imagination?
No, I don't think we don't sit around the table when government makes policy decisions around all sorts of areas of social policy, no. We may field some of the organisations that we fund who have evidence and data that they want to share with policymakers. But I think the key thing that one has to recognise is we are actually a part of government, because we're a non-departmental public body. So we only exist within the government family. Now, we also operate within what are called policy directions, which government sets about really where the money gets directed. Now, they're very permissive, but one of the absolute principles in them is that we don't substitute for government funding, and that's written across all the lottery distributors.
This goes back to that old
additionality. Yes, it's the additionality point. Yeah. Now, the additionality point, of course, has never been a binary issue, I would argue, because, I mean, I remember donkeys years ago having this conversation about, you know, what's additional and what isn't. So it's always a moving feast that you have to work your way through. I think our argument about our choices about funding are, of course, they're driven by what people ask us to fund. But the choices we make are set against, if you like, the kind of organisational framework and principles that we have. So our kind of strategic framework is all about putting people in the lead. So what we're interested in is how does it impact and affect the community? And our kind of theory of change, if you like, is that communities thrive when people are in the lead. So what we're interested in when people come to us is how are they demonstrating that? Now, they could be doing that through an arts project, or it could be about kids' sport. That's the sort of territory we're in, and those are the judgments that we're making, rather than making judgments against a kind of government policy environment, although that clearly impacts on the sort of stuff that comes up.
The independence that you have then, how does that work when, let's say, an organisation applies for funding to the Department of Health, and the Department of Health said, well, we can't help you, but, oh, our friends at the National Lottery might be able to help you out. I mean, there's an element to which organisations probably, I'm guessing, get bounced onto you.
You would be surprised by how infrequently that appears in that overt way, if I may say so.
Very well answered.
Well, if it's covert, we don't see it.
So you don't get any ministers ringing you up in the middle of the night saying, could you fund this organisation? They've been bothering us for months.
I'm so glad you've asked this question, because it's a question I have been asked ever since I arrived, because there is this kind of conspiracy theory that we're constantly being nobbled by ministers to, you know, put our funding to this organisation or that organisation. I have
Which
to say...
Which, of course, never happens.
It doesn't. So, you see, you don't believe me.
Can I come in from for instance?
Yeah. Yes.
Certainly local government funding at the moment for charities is drying up.
Yeah.
Okay. My understanding is that the lottery, and I may have this wrong, so please correct, that what you're looking at in some of your assessment of bids coming in...
Yeah.
Is to look at, is there more than one charity involved in this bid? Okay. And a collective of charities working together. Is that how you see the funding going forward? Because it's causing big challenges in the charity sector to do that.
So that is incorrect.
Good.
Because we have three primary funding products.
Right.
And partnerships is one of them. So just sort of to kind of pricey that, we have National Lottery Awards for All, which are the small, beautiful, under 10,000 quid, one-off grants, very community-driven. I see them as the sort of lifeblood, because it's absolutely going out into local communities, often, you know, volunteer-led organisations, etc. We then have Reaching Communities. That's been around forever. We've changed the way we operate it a little bit, because we've become more place-based in the way in which we run things, so that our folk are out in the field more. And that is the core product for what I would call probably medium-sized charities. Yeah. Now, when we assess those, we will look at, and we had a great example of this in the Southwest a couple of years ago, when we ran a little session for organisations working with older folk. Yeah. And of course discovered that there were sort of seven or eight, all of whom were pretty much wanting to ask for the same thing at the same time. They didn't actually know each other. So in that instance,
it
was a very sensible thing for us to do, which was say, are you sure you want to put in seven different bids, or do you actually want to think about how you could work together? And we would also look at a charity and say, so what is it doing that is unique and different to that one down the road? But can I just finish on the third product, which may be what you think, which is partnerships.
Yeah.
And there we are looking for where folk come together, because by working together, they can have greater impact.
This working together.
Yeah.
What if they don't? What if they don't work together? Do you turn around and say, fine, there is no grant? Do you facilitate them working together? And how do you get past people's egos?
that's a lot of questions in one question. So the question about what would our role be in that situation is, we're not a development agency, nor should we as a funder start trying to second guess how organisations can run themselves. So I think we're more in the business of nudging and encouraging, not telling. And we talk about that in the context of something called generous leadership. Absolutely understanding that you're in an ecosystem. And I learned this from the arts sector, actually, very interestingly, where I felt that when I started working in the arts, the big national companies, for example, kind of saw their role with, let's say, if you're a museum, a regional museum, kind of loaning some of their slightly B-list pictures or objects with very stringent requirements around, you know, conditions, and they had to pay for it all. Or whatever. And then over time, I think the big players started to recognise actually that they were interdependent with the small players, and that it was in their interests and in the interests of the common good around the museum sector for the whole ecosystem to flourish, and therefore actually having curatorial exchanges or enabling the development of conservation skills in the smaller or regional museums. And I suppose I saw that more collegiate behaviour. And what I noticed when I moved into the charitable sector is that a more competitive form of behaviour was more dominant, encouraged, I think, by funding in some ways. So what we're interested in with generous leadership is to try to address that. So absolutely about understanding you are in an ecology, and therefore you should have an acute understanding of what you bring to that ecology and an understanding of how you can work collaboratively in a team, which comes back to your personality point.
I'm just interested that this idea of identifying leaders with lived experience.
Yes.
You know, there'll be people listening to this podcast who will think, well, you know, am I the sort of person that they would consider to be a leader with lived experience?
Yeah.
What sort of characteristics are you looking for in that?
So that's different to generous leadership. Okay. But leaders with lived experience, what we're talking about there is that we have increasingly valued what you might call technical experts, and not recognised that individuals who have lived experience actually are experts by experience, and they not only can help design better solutions, but actually it's their table that we are often sitting at.
When you've got something like developing communities, my experience is that it takes a huge amount of time to develop trust among people. It takes time to bring those people together in the first place. What I'm interested in now is how reactive can you be over things that suddenly hit? So, for example, knife crime. A lot of people in the community would argue this didn't suddenly hit. They saw it coming.
So, actually, that's a really good example, because I sit on the Home Secretary's Serious Youth Violence Task Force, and it's been a really disturbing exposure to the issue and the complexity of the issue. We've looked actually at our funding around it, and interestingly, our funding has gone up and down very slightly around it as the trends have changed, which is quite encouraging in some ways, because that means people have been coming to us in that way. What we've been doing through grant funding is actually asking young people what they think the issues are, what they want to see in their community.
Coming back to this idea of community and that sort of faith that you then have to have in community, how strong is your faith in that?
Oh, absolutely. Actually, the longer I've done this job, the more I have thought actually the solutions lie with communities. Policymakers can provide infrastructure and support, but actually it's communities resourced and supported sustainably that actually often have the solutions. I mean, you can't help in my job but think this. You know, last week I was in Exeter and visited an amazing organic arts garden, which was working with people with mental health. And, you know, some people had been going there twice a week for 9 years. This was part of their daily lives. And, you know, wherever I go, anywhere in the United Kingdom, you find hundreds and thousands of people doing the most extraordinarily uplifting, moving things.
Is this the big society that we were told to expect? Have we got to that point?
Well, it already existed.
It's always been there, though. That's the thing. Yeah, I'm here.
Somebody's just rebranded it, and that's what was so infuriating.
Yeah, but has it been held back because of...
Well, it's an interesting...
Well, you're enabling, in a way.
Well,
we should be enabling it.
So are you more risk-averse now in giving your grants than maybe you were, or are you more risk...
Oh, no, I think we're probably more risk-taking, yeah, but calculated risk. But why do you ask that question? Because so what's the correlation between the joy of the people-led and risk?
Because I think there are too many charities out there trying to do the same thing.
Yeah.
So therefore the risk is... Who do I give the money to?
Yeah.
Or do you go, no, we won't touch any of them?
So I don't agree with you about there being too many charities.
Okay.
Because there are a very small number of very large charities that receive about 80% of the revenue in the sector, and they're highly professionalised. And then you've got the guys in the middle who really are, I think, the squeezed middle. Are we asking the wrong question about the number of charities, or have we actually got the wrong structure? And should some of those very, very large charities become the platforms that support some of the smaller ones, and so on and so forth? So in other words, I think the number of charities is the wrong question.
But this interesting area of risk and how maybe there's a sense in which you're attracted by that and you want to go into areas. I mean, and this does get you potentially in contentious areas, and we have to raise the controversy around £500,000 grant to the transgender support charity Mermaids last year, which was then publicly accused by quite a lot of people of pushing young people who were suffering from some sort of gender dysphoria into these life-changing medical interventions. Looking back on that incident, was that a learning curve for you? Do you regret that? And ultimately, what did you learn from it?
Do I regret it? No. So there was a lot of controversy around Mermaids. We received probably more correspondence about that than any other grant, certainly on my watch. Mm. I would have to say that there were many people that were supportive, as well as many people who were not. And of course, when people complain about our grants, we will inevitably look at it. Whatever the grant is, we'll do that. It's just usually there aren't quite so many.
Did you expect the outcry? Did you expect the criticism?
I think we didn't expect it to be as vocal and as angry as it was. There are some spaces that are highly contested. It's a bit like society in some ways at the moment, that you have two polarised communities, and finding the still small voice of calm in the middle is difficult. And that's where we need to be in some ways. But what we did do was we looked at what is this organisation doing. Fundamentally, it was an organisation that had grown out of people with lived experience. It was a support group for folk who were experiencing these issues. It was therefore very much within the ethos of what our strategy says. So it met all our criteria. And what we then looked at was, you know, any particular issues that were raised and did we find reason to suspend or withdraw the grant? And we didn't. And we produced a 25-page report on that. So, yeah.
And at the end of the day, Mermaids got the money.
Yes. Yeah. They're an interesting organisation who are moving from being small into a more professionalised environment with a very, very strong spotlight on them. Yeah. So that's quite a tough place for any charity to be.
Let's just do a little section. I think we ought to talk about the application process.
Yes.
The real advice that you would give to people. I'm sure you have them all the time when people discover who you are at a party and discover what the size of money you have to give away.
I always tell them I'm the worst person to ask because I'm a chief executive who has got no idea.
Let's have a look at it. So applying for grants, time-consuming, cumbersome. I'm sure you've heard the criticism. What are you doing to make it easier?
So we've changed our grant application process a lot. 5 years ago, Awards for All, you probably had a 20-page application form, and this is for an under £10,000 grant. It's about 8 clicks in total now for an A4A application, so it's much, much smoother.
And so what advice do you give to those charities applying for funds?
Be honest. That's a very difficult thing for charity to be to a funder, I know, but be honest. Be mission-focused. Demonstrate where you're adding value and tell us about the risks.
Inspire. A little bit of grabbiness, a bit of sexiness in the pitch?
No, we don't like sales pitches. No. People see through them straight away. The other thing I would say is don't put loads and loads of work in before talking to us.
Yeah.
Because it is a conversation, and we really want to have an early conversation where we can say to people, actually, you know, we're never going to fund that.
Yeah.
Or, actually, there's something in here, but it's not quite right. So why don't you go away and think about this and this and this, and maybe come back in 6 months when this
That's
has happened
the
or whatever.
Co-creation.
Yeah. Yeah. And then Absolutely. The work comes when the chances are higher, if I can put it that way.
I do think, though, Dolman, it's extremely difficult to go back to the being honest thing.
Yeah.
Part of the being honest is saying, I actually don't know what I'm doing at this point. I have a pretty good idea of what it is I want to achieve. I don't know how to get there. And I can't encapsulate what I want to achieve in 5 words. No. Help.
So one might say, well, go away and do a bit more work yourself. But one might also say, yeah, that sounds a bit interesting. So we might be interested in giving you a bit of development funding. And you could have 6 months of funding to work up your idea. But I think we also need to be a bit pushbacky.
Yeah, I get that. But I like that interim idea. Yeah. That, yes, you've got something, you need to think about what it is,
and we
but
have
here's
been,
something to help you along.
And we've been doing that in our UK portfolio for quite a while. We've been doing it in some of the other portfolios more recently. And one of the things that comes out of it is sometimes there is only a development grant because it doesn't go anywhere.
Exactly.
And that's totally fine.
That's the right to fail.
Yeah.
One final thing. I mean, we started the conversation talking about buying our first lottery tickets, the excitement and all that sort of thing. Are you confident that that funding model is going to sustain, that people will still keep on a Saturday afternoon or whatever it is, getting their numbers out of their wallet, going into the local news agents, buying a lottery ticket?
It's a really, really interesting question because 80% of national lottery ticket sales are still retail. They're not online. Mm. We were just having this conversation yesterday about, you know, what is the call you make around sort of digital? Is it all going to end up actually online or will it not? So I think that in order to thrive and in order to actually continue to play the extraordinary role it's played over the last 25 years, there is no question that we have to nurture and cherish it, and it has to adapt and change.
I would hate it to go all online. And the reason for that is in rural communities, which is one I live in, the upselling in the little corner shop when someone goes in for a lottery ticket.
It's really interesting.
Is absolutely really powerful.
Yeah.
You know, and they go and they buy pasty or they go and buy the paper or whatever that helps that community sustain a shop in their area.
Yeah.
That's why I'd hate it to go all tech.
We'll feed that back.
Thank you. Well, I've done something today anyway.
So final thing, here you are presiding over this huge fund. Is there ever a moment when you think, you know what, I wouldn't have liked to be back in that fringe theatre company I started 25 years ago?
Yes, because, you know, this is a very big juggernaut. It's 600 million quid, thousands of grants, and sometimes you just think, wouldn't it be nice to do something very small, very personal?
Oh, well, you could go and start a charity.
I could go and start a charity, couldn't I?
Fantastic. Dawn Allstwick, the Chief Exec of the National Lottery Community Fund, thank you very much.
Thank you very much for having me. It's been a pleasure.
This is Good Charity, Bad Charity. We've just had the experience of meeting Dawn Allstwick, the Chief Executive of the National Lottery Community Fund. Okay, one word.
Enjoyable.
Camilla?
Incredibly.
I'll
get to the one word. Generous.
I'd say empathetic.
All of this.
It's an extraordinary story that she has, isn't it? That idea that she was there at the receiving end of a national lottery grant for, what was it?
50 million,
coming through in a fax machine. That must give her an incredible empathy with those people who are now going through the trauma, and let's face it, it is trauma for a lot of people, of applying for funding. And I think a lot of that comes out in the way that she is helping to kind of humanise the process.
She didn't come over as a huge presence of a CEO. She comes over as somebody who listens. I love the way she said, so we got the 50 million, and they all went, oh my God, now we have to produce. So she understands fear.
Yeah, they called her bluff. I mean, I think she enjoyed it because she was also two-way. She challenged back.
Yeah, you had a hard time.
Yeah, I did, but that's fine, isn't it? That's absolutely fine. That's what we're here about, isn't it? Yeah. But I thought what she came out with was mission focus was really, really important to her, so that charities need to be clear about what their mission is and try and deliver to that, and the fact that it's people processed as well.
Yeah,
of course it is. And I think that she is also very keen that she doesn't lose the grassroots connection. In other words, if you're simply talking about grant processes and never meeting the people, where do you get the satisfaction? And she comes across as somebody who has huge satisfaction out of her job.
But then that question, when we asked her about whether she has faith in the concept of community, absolutely, it's a no-brainer for her. Communities are the way forward. But also the faith in leaders emerging from those communities who could be trusted.
And it's right. And the nice way she said, you know, be honest with us. Because I know charities are so desperate to get the money, they're going to want to emphasise the big picture for them, what they can achieve. And that's not lying, but it's their dream. But she was saying, just be, if you can only do 10, just say you're going to do 10 and not say we can hit a million. Her awareness, I thought, was brilliant.
OK, let's wrap up. Good Charity, Bad Charity is produced by Dan Hardoon, recorded here at Whistledown Productions. You can find us on all podcast platforms. Trawl through our back catalogue, by all means, for some more honest conversations with charity leaders. And look at our website, goodcharitybadcharity.com. Sponsor us. Help us keep going. We'd love to hear from you. Drop us an email. From me, David Prest.
And from me, Keith Davis.
And from me, Camilla McGibbon.
Goodbye.
Goodbye.